So we're in a series, we've just started the second week of a series, which is called Head, Heart and Guts, Total Transformation. And Vidania kicked it off last week, starting with wisdom. So I've put this picture of Manjushri here because this figure represents wisdom. Now I'm not going to talk about him particularly at all. Vidania did that really well last week. I just wanted to have something a bit more kind of archetypal in front of us as I'm going to talk about the Dharma. But there's just some characteristics that it might be worth pointing out. So Manjushri is a very youthful and joyful figure. He holds a sword, and that sword is a sword of wisdom. So it can cut through our wrong views. And he holds a book of wisdom. So we're thinking about wisdom, but we're not thinking about the wisdom which is kind of like book knowledge. It's not the kind of wisdom where you know loads of stuff. It's the kind of wisdom where you know how things really are, that you understand how things really are, which is what I'm talking about tonight. I'm talking about how the Buddha described how things really are. And it's important that when the Buddha talked about the ideas of how things really are, he's always very pragmatic, he's very practical. What he wants to do is address human suffering, and suffering of other beings as well, actually. He wants to get to the roots of suffering. That's what he's interested in. And his vision as well is always embedded in what's called Pratityasamutpada, conditioned co-production, which Bodhinaga is going to talk about next week. And that's where we see how what the Buddha saw as part of his as he became enlightened, was that the world, the universe, our experience, is all conditions just arising, coming into being, and then passing away. So things come into being, they are for a bit, and then they fade away. And there are many millions and millions and millions of conditions in the world that are all interconnected. So, so many, many things happen. So it's about, so the Buddha's vision in which what I'm going to talk about is based, is this idea of conditioned co-production, things coming into being and passing away. And just before Christmas, for some reason, I decided I really wanted to read War and Peace. It's because I was going on holiday. And I finished it yesterday. Yeah. And so I don't know how many people have had a go at War and Peace. And it is really worth reading a lot of it because there's some amazing descriptions of the human condition and some brilliant characters that I feel like I've met and that I really know. But Tolstoy does go in for quite a lot of kind of writing of his ideas about history, which I didn't read all, I have to say. But one thing that was really interesting that came out of those ideas was a sense that in which, so he's writing about when Napoleon invaded Russia, overtook Moscow, and then left Russia, and many, many hundreds of thousands, I think, of soldiers died, and Russian people died during that time. And historians, Tolstoy says, talk about it as if there's like Napoleon in charge of one side and Tsar Alexander in charge of the other side. And it's really clear to see what the conditions are that come into being to make these wars happen. When a battle happens, it's because one particular general was better than another general. But Tolstoy's really keen on the fact that that's not true, that so many other conditions are in place, that sometimes people have battles and they do what should logically be the best thing, but it doesn't work that way because maybe the mood of the soldiers is in a certain way. And he also talks about how for individual people, we're like that as well. There are so many conditions in play in our personalities that it's really hard to tell what is affecting which. I mean, something is leading to something happening, but it's very complicated. So I suppose that kind of fitted for me really well with the Buddha's sense of the world as being many, many conditions that are all in play together. You could use like a metaphor of an ocean. So a huge ocean is the whole of our experience, the whole of reality, the whole of the universe. And each of us is just like a tiny little wave in that ocean. Or you could use like the image of a river, a huge great river pouring down the side of the mountain. And we're just one little eddy in that river. So of course, each wave and each eddy is part of the ocean. It's made up of the ocean or the river. It's made up of the water, okay? So it's no different, it's the same stuff. So we are the same stuff as this kind of whole conditioned co-production going on. We're all part of this same stuff. Yet, because I suppose it's so scary to be one little kind of thing in the universe, what we do is we isolate ourselves. So we try and give that little eddy or that wave some kind of an identity separate. And of course it is as well separate. But what we do is we can sort of take ourselves out as if we could be a wave without the ocean, as if we could be an eddy without the river. And when we do that, what we tend to do is we see the world in three ways that perhaps it isn't really. And what I'm going to talk about today, the way things are, is what the Buddha calls the three lakshanas, the three marks of conditioned existence, which is how things really are, but we tend to act as if they're not, and then we give ourselves loads and loads of hassle and suffering. So that's what we're talking about. So hopefully, the three lakshanas. So hopefully everybody here is going, yes, I remember the three lakshanas, whether it's from a recent course. We do start the newcomers course, which there's a new one starting tomorrow. We start with these three lakshanas in a positive form. So they are, I don't know if you can read that, but hopefully you know it anyway. So they are impermanence. So everything is impermanent, which we talk about the first week in a positive way, is that everything changes. That there's a lack of inherent self, which we talk about as interconnectedness. And that there is unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, which we talk about as happiness comes from within in a positive sense. So we start the newcomers course with these, but they are very profound. They're very profound. If we really lived as if we knew these three marks, these three characteristics of conditioned existence, we probably would live a very different kind of life. And I'm going to go through all three of them. I am going to talk a bit more about dukkha, which is unsatisfactoriness or suffering. I don't know why that is, it's just at the moment it seems to me there seems to be quite a lot of dukkha around in people that I know. And I just thought it was something that I wanted to explore more today. So let's just start with impermanence. So impermanence, everything is changing. And I suspect that for us nowadays, it's much easier for us to perhaps realise this than it was maybe for people at the Buddha's time, or certainly for people 200, 300 years ago, because science tells us that nothing stays the same. You know, the planets, our sun, all of those are changing, the solar system is changing, the universe itself is impermanent. It will last for a very long time, but it itself comes into being and then passes out of being. So everything changes. The mountains change, the sea changes, people change. So people get old, people die, the causes that have created life come to an end, and everybody will die in the end. So I suppose in a way that's the strongest sense of impermanence that we probably get as human beings. So why is it important to know this mark of existence, understand this lakshana? I suppose firstly for me, there's something about if I really know the impermanence of life, I can bring a different level of attention to it. And in that level of attention, things can become more beautiful. And actually I can be very much more present in my life. So, I remember years and years ago, about 10 years ago, when my dad was quite ill, and I had a picture of him that I really, really love, which is he's swimming in the sea with his dog, Scruffy. And it's just a really lovely picture of him swimming in the sea. And as he became iller, and he had dementia, so he wasn't able to communicate with me, I kind of, you know, looked back at that time with quite a lot of nostalgia. And then I thought, actually, when it was happening, you know, I wasn't really particularly present. It's like the photograph says something to me. But I was thinking about a person that I was in love with. I was having a bit of an argument with my mum at the time. Do you see what I mean? It was like, there was my dad swimming in the sea with a dog, and I really wasn't noticing it particularly. If someone hadn't taken a picture, I might not even remember it now. And there's something about now I look back at that picture and I just think it really helps me to want to be in the present when things are happening so that I notice that, so that I can really take that to heart and enjoy it. And hopefully not in any kind of a horrible way, but just in a way that the more present I am, actually the more enjoyable life is, the more I appreciate people. So that's one reason, knowing impermanence, because it will happen that we will lose people, things will change. And if the more that we can be present to the situation as it happens, the more we can appreciate our lives. I suppose the second is that actually it can just really help us. So we can have a sense that, you know, if I get my life organized, everything will be all right. And of course, things change. And then we get really upset. So maybe our jobs change. It might be that we may get made redundant, or the circumstances of our job changes, our conditions of our job change, or our relationships change, the political situation changes, civilizations come and go. They seem very strong at the time, but you know, presumably the civilization we're in right now will at some time, you know, pass out of being. I presume people who were part of the Roman Empire thought this is great and it's going to continue forever, you know. And all those other empires that have been since then. But things come and things go. And I think because we've got an idea that there might be a safe place, you know, we might get a job for life and it will be great. We might get a relationship for life and it will be great. We'll get a nice house and it will be great. But of course, as things change, those things change. And I think the more we know that those things are likely to change, the less we'll try and get what they can't give us, the less we'll try and get some kind of very neurotic kind of support from them. Yeah, so it's a bit like the more that we know impermanence, the less hopefully we'll suffer. The third is sometimes we're in a situation we don't like. So we might not like, I don't know, we might be ill, we might be in pain, we might be with people we don't like, in a situation we don't like, in a political situation we don't like. And the great thing about impermanence is we know, well, it will change. It will change. I remember at school, my RE teacher. So one thing I really remember from school is this. My RE teacher said to me, everything will change. And it was so helpful that he said that to me when I was about 14. I really, you know, it's like if I was in a situation which I was unpleasant, I could think, it will change. And of course, a really important thing about impermanence is that everything changes, is we can work with that. We can work with the fact that everything changes. So we can use karma, which Bodhinaga is going to talk about next week. We can work with the law of karma so that we can change in the way that we would like to change, to become happier, to become more positive. I'll just let the person come in. And I think that's a really important thing as Buddhists. I was reminded that in a way that's quite radical to some people. Someone was telling me a little bit about a family dynamic at the weekend, and a difficult situation, and someone who's got like quite a strong amount of suffering in their life because of something that happened to them as a child, but they've got the idea they can't change. They can't change. So that's really horrible, isn't it? If you have this idea that the way that you are now is the way you will always be until you die, that's just a really difficult way of looking at the world, which many people have, actually. And maybe we also might look at any ideas we might have unconsciously about ourselves, actually. That's just the way I am. Oh, I'm quite bad-tempered, and that's just the way I am. I can't do this. I can't give talks in public, because that's just the way I am. Whatever it is that you might have, there might be ideas that you have unknown to yourself. I mean, I don't think, you know, it's not always easy to change. It's not always easy to work with this lecture of impermanence, but I think it is very possible, and hopefully all of us can see examples in ourselves of how we've been able to change more positively. So I suppose behind what we're here looking at wisdom, we're looking at the Buddha's view of the way things really are. And the Buddha's challenging us, I suppose, to look at our views of how we think we are. Because behind everything that we do, every way we behave, that we react, there will be a view that we hold. So, for instance, the view that I was just talking about is, well, I can't change this particular thing about myself. That is a view that we hold that will change, will affect our lives. And I suppose the view that we have about not wanting impermanence, finding impermanence difficult, is that we really want things to stay how they are because we know how they are. Even if they're difficult and they're not, you know, really working for us, we often want them to stay the way that they are. And I suppose behind it is fear. It's a fear that actually we can't manage things if they change. And I suppose there's something there that sometimes that is true, but it's also really important maybe to look at your experience and look at perhaps it's been times when you have been changing, when things have changed, like maybe you've had to go change your job or change your relationship, move to a different place, might be exactly the time when you have grown the most, even if it was really difficult. So there's something about exploring that view, perhaps. Okay, so that's a little bit about impermanence. So now a little bit about the second lakshana, which is the lack of inherent self-nature, which we talk about positively as interconnectedness. So as we say in the newcomer's course, it's not just that everything changes, it's that there are no things to change. So there are no fixed things that stay the same way forever and ever and are inherently of themselves. So in the Buddha's time, the way that people would have seen, some people would have seen reality would have been that there is something fixed. There's what's called Atman, which would have been some kind of, a bit like a soul, something fixed within a person that would stay the same, that would carry on from life to life. I suppose we might have a sense in Christianity of having some kind of a soul that might, you know, carry on after we die, that somehow is inherently us that will continue. So the Buddha said, neither of those are true. What is true is that there is this flow of conditions, as I talked about, a flow of conditions. Now, of course, we are born and die in the same body, kind of. It's very difficult to say that the body you have when you're first born is the same body as when you maybe get to be 85. But there is some kind of sense of connectedness there, isn't there? There's a stream. So the Buddha talks about there is a stream of connection, but there is nothing that stays the same. So there's nothing that you could say is inherently fixed. So for instance, this, a door, or this thing, you know, it is at the moment being this particular piece of wood, but a few years ago it was a tree. Before it was a tree, there was a whole load of conditions that came together. There must have been, like, I don't know what kind of tree it was, but say it was an oak tree, there would have been an acorn, and there would have been all sorts of conditions like the water and the soil that grew into a tree, and then somebody cut it down and they cut it up, and for now it's like this. But maybe in about 30 years, somebody might go, oh, we've had enough of that. We don't want a boring old lectern like that. We need like some really modern one. And we'll burn it or something. And it will turn into fire, a different kind of energy. So although it is in a process, everything is in a process. And I think that's kind of easy to see for physical things. And perhaps it's even quite easy to get a sense of it, at least for our bodies. So you can see that everything in our bodies has come from somewhere else. So there are bones that we have, our skeleton, that's come from calcium that we've eaten. It's come from bits and pieces of other things. There's the blood, there's the water in our bodies that we've drunk, that's become. So it's a bit like everything in our body has come from the outside, and it will go back into the outside as well. At the moment, we're like all breathing the same air. So the molecules that I'm breathing in and then breathing out, you're also breathing in and breathing out. It's like we're very much connect our bodies in that way, are connected and are interconnected with each other. I think it's harder to see when it comes to our kind of mental psychic selves, I suppose, our psychological selves, because we have a very strong experience of this is me, and I have these really great ideas which I've thought up, and they're kind of different from everybody else's. And I think that's a very natural way to experience the world, but actually if we examine it, we can see that's not true. Because all my ideas that I've got come from the society that I live in. The language that I'm speaking, English, has come from, you know, I learned that from my parents and from my school. The ideas I have, well, it's amazing how similar they are to lots of other people of my generation. Do you know what I mean? If I look at it, it's like, you know, my ideas about sorts of things would be, you know, if there was another woman my age, we'd probably, you know, many of us would think very similarly. It's like, you know, lots of the ideas that we have about way things should be, we get from our culture. And yet to us, somehow they seem that they're different from the culture, but they're no different in a way from the way that we are, you know, we're breathing in air and breathing out air. It's exactly the same with the ideas. We take them in and then we pass them around to other people. So that's, yeah, we're very interconnected. And you know, even my accent changes. You know, it's like when I'm here, I have a certain accent. When I'm with my mum and sister, I have a certain accent. Sometimes I get a bit more northern, sometimes a bit less northern. It's just like quite interesting. You know, even that, you know, the way that I talk will change. And the way we see the world, I was thinking about a really, I don't know, probably small example, but it's like the cut of trousers. So when I was like about, I don't know, about 16, the fashion at that time was to have really, like, really big trousers, like jeans that were really wide and quite flared, okay? And then suddenly they went really skinny, and for a while I was like, I can't, and people look really stupid in skinny jeans. How could I wear those? But of course, after a while, they started to look quite good to me, so I went and got some skinny jeans. And then after a while, it was like, everyone's wearing really baggy jeans now, but they look really stupid. But then I got a sense that they look great as well, so I'll go and get some baggy jeans. And I think this might have happened about 4 times in my lifetime so far. It's like the kind of, you know, just really interesting, like the cut of trousers. And it's like each time there's a bit where something happens, sort of where I take on what is the fashion of the time, and it becomes something that I actively like or dislike, if you see what I mean. It's like I'm just part of this flow of ideas of all sorts of different white things. So that means that it's important who we mix with, because the people we mix with will influence us. It's important what we watch, what we read, what we look at on our phones, how we spend our time, because all of that will be affecting us all the times. And of course, we're also influencing other people. So what we say matters. When we come out of this hall and go down to our groups, we'll all be slightly different because of the experience of being in here. After our groups, we'll all be slightly different. After the meditation, we'll all be slightly different. It's like all the time we are changing and we are responding. So there's nothing fixed in us. There's nothing fixed in us. So why do we have this this mark? What's the importance of it? Well, I think it's really important, isn't it? As I've talked about, it shows how we're influenced by other people, how we influence other people. If we really know it, I think there's something about we no longer need to protect, a sense of this this ego self that needs protecting all the time. I think there's something about we really start to see interconnectedness much more. And we become much happier, of course, because we're letting go of the sense of ourselves as separate. We realize how really interconnected with it we are. This particular lakshana people often concentrate on when they're kind of trying to move towards insight, really progress. And I think obviously there is a sense in which you know, seeing the emptiness of a fixed self is a really important thing to do. But I think it can also lead to us getting a bit self-obsessed. So I think one of the things we really try and do at this centre is we encourage people to look to others, to try and have a sense of interconnectedness. So rather than getting obsessed with how you're doing and your own kind of lack of fixed self, there's something about expressing the lack of fixed self in actually connecting with other people. And actually it's interesting because I can, you know, like if you go on a lovely retreat, do some lovely meditation or something, you might get a sense of this kind of being in harmony with the world, not so much of a fixed self. There's nothing like then having a bit of an argument with somebody and realizing how fixed myself really is. So other people are just a really good way to work on this sense of ourselves as being fixed in a certain way. Okay, so we've talked about two of them. We've talked about impermanence, we've talked about the lack of inherent self, interconnectedness. So now we're going to talk about the third one, which is unsatisfactoriness or dukkha. So the first two are sort of the way that things are in the world. Dukkha is about our approach to reality, I suppose, our approach to these particular lakshanas, the fact we are impermanent, that we don't have a fixed self. And the word dukkha is really interesting because it has been translated quite often as suffering. But actually it does include suffering, but it also can be just the very unsatisfactoriness of life that we all experience. So apparently some people think that the word might mean something like the ill-fitting wheel of a chariot. So dukkha, do means kind of bad or not fitting well, and car is chariot, which is really interesting because I think, anyway, it must be a word that's similar maybe to our word car. I don't know. So you get a sense of a chariot with an ill-fitting wheel, And as you travel along, it's going to be quite a bumpy ride. So I suppose the idea of dukkha is that we have quite a bumpy ride in life. So it's not just suffering, though it does include that. It's also just that kind of thing's not going quite right for us. So traditionally, there are many forms of unsatisfactoriness we can experience, which I'm just going to quickly run through. So there's the unsatisfactoriness of birth. So to be born is painful, I think. To be born is painful. I think it's quite a traumatic thing that the child goes through when it's born. So there's that, you start off with unsatisfactoriness. Then there's the unsatisfactoriness of aging, of starting to lose, you know, your strength, your flexibility, not being able to do what you could do before, all those kind of things. And there's the unsatisfactoriness of sickness, and finally of death. I mean, the thing is, you know, all of us want to live. We don't want to die. And yet, that is exactly where we're heading. So there's like this unsatisfactoriness. Then another traditional form is of being joined with what we don't like. So many of us have to spend quite a lot of our time doing with people in places we don't like. Maybe your work, for instance. You might find yourself a lot of the time doing something you don't like with people you don't like. Or you might even find that people you love very much sometimes really irritate you. So your family might irritate you, your friends might irritate you sometimes. It's like, wherever we live, whatever we do, there are going to be things that we don't like. Another form of unsatisfactoriness is being separated from what we do like. So that happens a lot, doesn't it? We can find ourselves in a situation which we really enjoy, and we can't be with that person for what some reason. We can't do it because we have to go to work, so we can't do whatever it is that we love doing. Yeah, so that's a common experience, and probably, a very common experience. Then the next one is of not getting what we want. So that happens every day, all day, doesn't it? The unsatisfactoriness of I want something and I can't have it. Even if it's very small, or maybe it's big, but there's going to be lots of examples of that. So there's all the time this kind of level of unsatisfactoriness in being a human being. And even if we do have pleasure and enjoyment in our life, there might be a sort of hidden, concealed unsatisfactoriness behind that. So for instance, we may really enjoy something, but someone else may have suffered so that we can have it. So for instance, if we were to tuck into a big plate of roast beef, the cow that has died so that we can eat that roast beef will have suffered. If we, certain clothes that we might enjoy wearing, somebody may have worked really long hours to make those clothes in very difficult situations. The same with lots of gadgets, actually. Lots of gadgets we enjoy using, get a lot of pleasure from. Somebody may have worked in really horrible conditions to make that gadget for us. And I think we might put that out of our mind a bit, or try to put it out of our conscious mind, but it stays with us of a sense of guilt, perhaps even a sense of anxiety, that we know in a certain way, it's a bit kind of icky, we know that, oh, it's great, I just went to Primark and I bought loads of clothes, I'm quite excited by that, but actually, probably the people that made those clothes probably worked in very bad conditions to do it, for instance. We can feel this unconscious guilt, this unconscious anxiety around that. When we are experiencing pleasure and good times, we might fear that they're going to come to an end. So if you do have the kind of job which is you don't like, you might find that on a Sunday. It's a bit like you've had a really nice weekend. Sunday evening, you start to get that feeling of, oh no, this pleasure is coming to an end. Tomorrow I have to go to work. Or you might go on holiday, really enjoy that, but then there's that knowing that it will, it won't continue. Then there's pleasure that's linked to suffering. So I think for me, an example of this is the kind of romantic stuff, actually. It's a bit like romance can seem really exciting, but then there can be, if there's a certain, get too attached, all that kind of thing, there can be suffering that comes with that. There's a suffering that comes with getting very attached, perhaps getting neurotically attached, trying to expect too much from a relationship than it can give. So there's that sense of, pleasure that comes with suffering. And then there's the final kind of suffering, which is the kind of traditional list of suffering, which is just because anything that is conditioned, which means that it's made up of all these conditions, it won't give us satisfaction. And that's because we are bigger beings, that we have something in us that is growing towards something bigger, something deeper. And actually, it's never going to quite work for us if we try and get pleasure all the time. So I've talked a lot here about pleasures, if perhaps it was a bad thing, and it really isn't. Okay, so I don't think that Buddha ever said that pleasure was a bad thing that I know of, because we need to have pleasure and joy in our lives, but what we need to do is be truthful about where we get it. We need to understand, be really truthful about, does actually, I don't know, going to Primark and buying 5 t-shirts, is that really going to give me pleasure? Yes, so there's nothing wrong with pleasure, it's really, really important, but we just need to be really clear where we're really getting pleasure from. And we might find that as we practice more, we start to get pleasure perhaps in different ways as well. Okay, so suffering. So actually hearing about there is suffering, the first noble truth, there is suffering, actually was a great relief to me, which I was surprised by, because why I found it so helpful is because I think until then I thought if only I do everything right, I could get to a stage where I no longer suffer. And actually, even more than that, I probably thought if I do everything right, I could get to a stage where nobody suffers. So there's a bit like, if only I, you know, worked really hard and did this and tried to get the right this and the right this and juggled everything right and then was involved in trying to make the world a much better place, we could get to a stage where there would just be no suffering at all. And what the Buddha's saying is that while we are not enlightened, there is no such place. There is suffering. And actually, of course, that's horrible to suffer, but it's also a great relief because it means that I'm not failing if I'm suffering. I'm not kind of a bad person if I'm suffering. It's just there is suffering in being a human being. Suffering is just an inherent part of the human experience. And it's like nobody wants to suffer, as I've said, and yet in reality, everyone experiences some type of pain or other. And actually what the Buddha suggests is that instead of being driven solely by we're trying to get rid of this suffering, what we need to do is change our relationship with it. So of course some pain and some suffering can be eased, and it should be. So you know, if you've got a really bad headache, it's really important to take some painkillers. If somebody is suffering because they are being persecuted, it's really important to stop that persecution. If somebody's suffering because they don't have enough food, it's really important that they get enough food. So there is, it is important to ease the pain that we can, but there is some pain, so chronic physical pain, the fact we get old, the fact that we die, the not getting what we want, all of this is part of the human condition. And the Buddha talked about in a sutta called Salata Sutta, or the Two Arrows Sutta, he talked about how we might be with dukkha. So he talked about a person who gets shot by an arrow and obviously feels some pain and then immediately starts thinking about, oh my God, this is the end of my life, what am I going to do, where did the arrow come from and who shot the arrow, and all these kind of things around the arrow. So it's a bit like that person's been shot by the second arrow. So we get the first arrow. So the first arrow is I break my leg, there's pain there. The second arrow is when I start getting incredibly anxious and catastrophizing and going, this is the end of the world as I know it, I'm never going to be able to walk again, I'm going to be in pain for the rest of my life, that kind of thing. And actually, I've got quite a good example. Is I went for a walk quite a while ago with Tracy here, and I got this really weird pain in my leg. And it was like, I don't know what it was, because it went away after a few hours, but I literally walked till I couldn't walk properly, and I was thinking, oh my God, that's it. I've had the thing that's going to ruin my life. And now what's going to happen is I'm going to have this kind of really weird, like it's this condition, the doctors won't know what it is, I'll have it forever. Like where I live, I have to kind of go up a ladder to get to bed. I won't be able to live there anymore. I'll be in so much pain that I'll be really horrible to everyone and they'll hate me, so I won't be able to have any friends anymore. And this had all happened incredibly fast. So the first arrow is like a bit of a pain here. And then all these other arrows about what I thought was going to happen. Yeah, so it was quite a dramatic example for me of the two arrows. Yes. So what did the Buddha say about how the response of a wise person to pain and the response of an ordinary person to pain? So the Buddha said, when an ordinary person experiences a painful bodily feeling, They worry, agonize, and feel distraught. Then they feel two types of pain. One is physical and one is mental. It's as if this person was pierced by an arrow and then afterwards by a second arrow, and they experience the pain of two arrows. Yes, so we get whatever it is, we might get physical pain, or we might have some kind of an emotional pain, mental pain, and then we give ourselves even more pain on top of it. And then, so what the Buddha says is, having been touched by that painful feeling, they resist and resent it. They harbour aversion to it, and this underlying tendency of resistance and resentment towards this painful feeling comes to obsess the mind. So we resist and resent this first arrow, we harbour aversion to it, and from this underlying tendency of resistance and resentment, it starts to obsess the mind. So presumably it's not just me that has experienced this, and presumably you are thinking of times that you've also experienced this. As I said, it could be physical pain, it could be mental or emotional pain as well. And what happens is because the second arrow becomes, because we respond to the first arrow, our first pain, by trying to push it away. So the resistance itself becomes the cause of suffering. You know, so we might ask those questions like, why me? Why am I having to do this? So the Buddha then goes to say, what happens when we're experiencing that resistance? Touched by that painful feeling, the ordinary person delights in compulsive distraction, often through seeking pleasure. Why is that? Because compulsive distraction is the only way that they know to escape from painful feeling. This underlying tendency to craving for distraction comes to obsess the mind. So for some of us, that'll make immediate sense. So we'll know that feeling of like, oh, I'm feeling some anxiety. Quickly, I've got to get some chocolate. I've got to get some Netflix. I've got to get onto Facebook. Whatever it is, something that we'll, we want something to make it better. We go for distraction. And others might be thinking, that's not really my experience, actually, because when I do feel that that pain, I want to push it away. I want to push things away. It's like I'm not trying to seek pain, pleasure to replace it. I'm actually trying to push it away. And that might lead to a person getting quite angry, picking a fight, blaming other people, blaming themselves. And actually that has a pleasure of itself. So that pleasure of feeling quite righteously angry can be a way that we can distract ourselves from what's from this resistance we're feeling. Yes, so the Buddha thinks, I don't know if it was the Buddha, but somebody said there are different types. So we have some people are greed types who go towards wanting distractions to when they feel this kind of this resistance and this to their pain. Other people are hate types and they look for a bit of a fight or something like someone to blame. That's a way to kind of not have to feel that pain. And what we do, so whichever way we do it, we're erecting a barrier that separates us from our unpleasant experience. Which seems sensible in a way, doesn't it? Why experience unpleasant feeling when you don't have to? The trouble is it gets us in a real mess. And there are two ways, perhaps two ways that we might get into a mess. So one is blocking and one is drowning. And these ideas I'm taking from somebody called Vidyamana. So Vidyamana set up Breathworks, which is an organization that's done a lot of work with mindfulness. And she's a person who, I think in her maybe early 20s, had two very horrible accidents, which left her disabled. Her spine is very damaged. She's in a lot of pain. But she's used that experience, I suppose, to develop a way that people who are also in pain can find, can manage their pain much better. So she teaches mindfulness for people to learn how to manage their pain. And so she talks about blocking and drowning. So blocking is where we run away from what we don't like. So we might feel a bit restless, we feel a bit driven, a bit brittle, like we can't stop. We get caught up in addictions as we attempt to block out the pain. So this is the one where you go for the alcohol, the cigarettes, the recreational drugs, shopping, chocolate, work, talking a lot, box sets, YouTube, whatever it is. There's lots of ways that we can do that. And each time that this pain we're feeling kind of breaks into our experience, what we do is we reach for more of our chosen drug, whatever it is, or drugs. And before we know it, we're just going round and round, kind of like a hamster in a wheel. We're just spinning round. And it's kind of a wheel of, we're in avoidance, anxiety, panic, quick, something to get rid of it. Bit more avoidance, you know, a bit more anxiety, a bit more panic. So we can go round like that. So that's one tendency we might have when we find ourselves experiencing dukkha. Our second tendency might be drowning, which is feeling overwhelmed. So we feel really preoccupied and overwhelmed by our pain, by our suffering. We lose perspective, we feel like we're drowning in it, and it's the only thing we can think about. So that can lead to us feeling really exhausted and depressed, and it's really hard to function in that state. And that what we're still doing, even though it looks like we're kind of we're thinking about our suffering a lot, we still want it to be different. We really want it to be different. So all this kind of drowning in it is because we want to be different from the way it is. And a common pattern for many people, and I really identify with this one, is first we do the blocking, so we run away. And we're kind of really hectically pursuing all these avoidance strategies we know. But then we get very tired because we're doing all that. We're not looking after ourselves. And then we crash, we feel overwhelmed. Maybe we have a bit of a rest, and then we're back again. Doing the back in that cycle of activity, and then we crash again. And some people that might be like sometimes it might be like a really long cycle. So you do one week you're really looking for ways, you know, doing a lot of the chocolate and the Netflix thing, and a few weeks later you've crashed. Or it might just happen in one day. Or even I can sometimes feel like that from moment to moment. It's like I'm doing distraction overwhelm. It can just go like that. So that's why it's a problem if we run away from our suffering, because that's what can happen. So what does the Buddha say is the wise response? So the Buddha says, when a wise person experiences a painful bodily feeling, they don't worry, agonize, and feel distraught. And they feel physical pain, but not mental pain. It's as if this person was pierced by an arrow, but a second arrow doesn't follow this, so they only experience the pain of a single arrow. So the wise person only feels the pain of a single arrow, doesn't do all the second arrow stuff. So I suppose a wise person is somebody who understands that dukkha is part of the human condition, and who's at peace with themselves, will experience the first arrow and manage to stay with it and not go into the second arrow. So even enlightened beings do suffer. They do feel pain. On Parinirvana Day, which is the day where we mark the passing away of the Buddha, which is coming up quite soon, on January the 17th, I think. No, it's coming up quite soon. We listen to stories of the months before the Buddha passed away. And you can really feel some of his suffering there. So he's got an old body that's just like, he says it's like it's tied together with string. It's just falling apart. He's got this body that's not working very well. He also experienced very painful dysentery, so very sharp pains. So a sense of him suffering there, but not going into anything more than just experiencing that suffering. There's also part of the story where he goes to visit some of the places. He goes on a tour just before he dies, and he goes to visit some of the places he really loved. And he says to his companion, you know, this place is really beautiful. What a beautiful place this is. And I don't know what is meant by that, but I do read some sense of perhaps he's experiencing a sense of emotional loss there. It's like he's seeing this place for the last time. So he's experiencing that kind of suffering, but he's not putting anything more onto it. Now, that's just my interpretation of that. It could be that he's just kind of, he doesn't do that, I don't know. That seems to me there's like a person there who's, you know, saying goodbye to places that he loved. So how do we do that? I mean, it's not easy, is it? When we are feeling strong suffering, it's not easy to stay with it. So perhaps we start with smaller things and we stay in the gap That is what we do, you know, that we teach on the newcomers course. We train ourselves to be able to stay with unpleasant sensations and to try and have some kind of creativity in the way that we respond, so that we don't find ourselves resisting and then either blocking or drowning in our resistance. And I suppose what we're very careful about is we look at our views behind our suffering. So we don't see the fact that we're suffering as a sign that we failed or that we're worthless. We just realise that suffering is part of the human experience. It goes with having this body, having this mind, that we are going to experience suffering. From the major sufferings like our own bodies, getting old, getting ill, bereavement, when we're bereaved, lose people that we love, to those smaller ones as well. And I suppose, I think as well as the mindfulness that we need to stay in the gap, we need bucket loads of metta as we do that, of self-metta, that we need to hold in a lot of metta. So that's how we can be with the dukkha that we experience. So, I've looked at the way that the Buddha said that things are. They are impermanent. They lack inherent self, and we experience suffering. And I've left the slide of Manjushri here because I think it's important that as we know that dukkha will be there for us, that life is impermanent, that we are not fixed, that we realise that by knowing that, we can start to enjoy life more. We can find joy and delight in life. We're no longer trying to keep everything fixed and separate. We can see ourselves as a wave in the ocean, as an eddy in the river, and we can just delight in our current experience.